Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Chathas, the player who took it, won the match in the semi-final, but they've got a goal here. The heading power of Haris Dayas. They've scored from a corner again. He lifted his head and Portugal hang theirs.
Such is the magnetism of the European Championships around the world. Might enjoy it even more if there's a goal, and Torres is in here, and Fernando Torres scores for Spain. And what was Jens Lehmann doing? He's broken the barrier. The drought is over for 24-year-old Fernando Torres. The goal comes out of nothing.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and tonight we're moving on to part five of the wonderful Stephen Scragg-inspired European Championship series. Before we introduce tonight's guest and the tournaments that we're going to be looking at, I'd like to introduce the two regular co-hosts for this wonderful series. First of all, the brainchild, Mr. Stephen Scragg. How are you, Stephen?
Very well, thanks, Stu. Very well. I've not been up to much in the last few days.
not been anywhere now.
But yeah, not been anywhere. Funnily enough, not been anywhere. But yeah, apart from that, yeah, all good. The sun's come back, and we were actually doing some keepy-uppies in the garden this afternoon, which was all very nice.
Oh, there is no better way to spend this time, is there, than a keepy-up competition in the back garden?
Exactly. It's coaching. And coaxing that like extra keepy up or sit out with the kids is it's worth the 3 hours of garden time.
Looking forward to tonight's edition.
Yes, looking forward to it. I mean, I think with the European Championships is that they have that greater longevity in tournaments, you know, feeling satisfactory in a way. World Cups for me tail off. You know, I think. We've said it before with World Cups, you're left feeling vaguely disappointed the closer they are to where we are now. And it's only as they go further away that you gain a greater appreciation. So, kind of like, for instance, 1998 is only just starting to feel attractive now at a 22-year distance. Whereas with the European Championships, you know, you might kind of like let things slip your mind. But as I'm watching stuff and looking at them and thinking, no, these were great tournaments that I enjoyed at the time, and they made me look forward to the next one.
You're absolutely right, like you're saying. I think I know we talk about the 8-team European Championships, but you know, as the sort of 16-team ones took on, you have this great concentration of talented sides as well, despite expanding the number of teams.
You do. It carried it off. You know, as sceptical as it was that it would do, the tournament did indeed kind of like carry off the 16-team tournament. The fact that it remains symmetrical, you know, it's four groups of four. You still get a group of death along the way, at least one. And there's only two teams going through. So, you know, you still have that propensity for big clashes during the group stages, some big head-to-heads, and some big casualties, knocking, you know, being knocked out in the group stages. And you know, to some extent, you know, not even qualifying on some occasions, you know, with 2008, what we'll be doing as part of tonight, you know, there was no England, you know, and, you know, this is, you know, it will come to it, but it still made it a fun tournament, though. And so probably similarities to 84 in a way, is the quality of the football of 2008 is often mirrored. Or mirrored masked by the fact that England weren't there as a nation. Maybe the blind eye was turned to an extent, but for football fans, you know, who just love the game anyway, generally, you know, 2008 is probably up there with the best.
It is. You're right. It is. And obviously, second co-host, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you doing?
Good, fine. Thanks, Stu. And unlike Stephen, I've been travelling around a lot. I've been to the kitchen, I've been to the living room, the bedroom, the balcony.
How are your keepy uppies going on the balcony?
Not so good. I mean, I can't do keepy uppies if I'm playing on grass. I'm standing on the balcony, mate. So, no. I haven't even got a ball here, so that would be difficult. And, you know, I could probably do it with a cushion or something. Mind you, I couldn't do it with a ball either. So, to celebrate. But, I'm good, thanks, matey. And it's great to be, you know, back talking about football on air again. And two interesting tournaments. And it's interesting. I was just looking back when doing it this afternoon. I was doing a bit of research. And I was actually on holiday for both these tours. I was in Spain for both of these tournaments. First, the 2004 when I was in Calpe, and the 2008 when I was in Rota when Spain won. So that was brilliant evening. That was when they won the title. So, some great memories for these tournaments for me.
Excellent. So some unique perspectives, I guess, then, when we get to talking about the final in 2008.
Definitely, mate, yeah. I mean, we were about the time. I'll talk about it when we get there. But, even in 2004, Spain were sort of... I mean, obviously, the tournament was in Portugal, I'm far away, and we used to go for a meal, and then there was a bar next to the hotel we were, and I'd go back and sit with the guy who was the bar owner watching the football till quite late at night. I mean, he couldn't speak English, and I can't speak much Spanish now, but I could speak even less then. But, you know, football is the international language, so there were some really nice nights, and we just sit down with a few gin and tonics together, and happy days, matey.
Excellent. Well, well, you might have gin and tonics tonight, to be fair. I'm not sure what everyone's got. I'm just with the regular... Diet Coke, obviously no product placement advert, but that's what I've got in front of me.
Yeah, I've just got a glass of water with too much tonight, mate.
All right. So obviously we headed, like I said, part five of our European Championships, and it sees us arrive at Portugal, as Gary said, in 2004, and then Austria and Switzerland 2008. Now, obviously, we have the shock and awe of Greece in 2004, which is obviously offset by the belated blossoming of the classic career dark horses, Spain. Two tournaments offered wildly different styles of champions, but, you know, Stephen's mentioned as well, two tournaments that largely hit the spot in terms of the football played and drama they created. Tonight's guest is the wonderful Mr. James Kelly, who has agreed to join us on this one. And wax lyrical about these two tournaments. James, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks, Stu. I'm on the water as well. I can put a shout out to Welsh Water. So thank you very much for supplying me with that. I'm kind of keeping busy, to be honest, because I'm in the unenviable position. I've got to write my dissertation because I'm in the final year of uni. So I can't really complain about being bored. But other than that, I'm keeping all right,
thanks. Oh, I know we're here to talk about football, but that's a shared comment. My eldest daughter's come back from London, and she's in the middle of writing her dissertation as well at the moment.
And well, I mean, I doubt hers is about the impact that Erdogan has in Turkey on Turkish football. But
I wish it was. It's about genetics. I'm clueless. I have zero clue about what hers is on. Absolutely zero. But yeah, if I could have convinced her to do it on football, I would have done. But yeah,
I mean, it took an awful lot of effort with my supervisor. It took, I think, I had about three or four more meetings than all of my other friends. But I managed to convince him in the end.
Oh, that's excellent, excellent, excellent. So you know, 2004, 2008. Are these when were your first European Championships that you can remember?
2004 was my first one, so. It's quite a significant tournament for me. I remember kind of before that, I knew football existed, but I'd never really kind of consciously sat down and watched it for prolonged periods, or kind of, I'd see bits and bobs of it on TV, and I knew who the main players were, but I didn't really know there was a structure to it, if that makes sense. Whereas with the Euro 2004, it kind of made it obvious to me that there was this set thing in place. And, you know, I remember getting I got the EA Sports, they made like a sort of Euro video game. I was on that for hours on end. I had the Panini sticker book, obviously, like just things like this that kind of made it all apparent to me that this, you know, football tournament existed. And from then on, I've basically, you know, been as addicted to football as the next person.
I mean, this is great because obviously, you know, we talk a lot about first tournaments and what people remember. So what we are, before we sort of get into the 2004 tournament, what are your sort of key memories then of that tournament?
Weirdly, one of the ones that stands out is Latvia, because I remember I didn't finish the Panini sticker book, but I just used to keep getting Latvian players. That's one of my earliest footballing memories. I think I must have got the Latvian goalkeeper. I can't remember his name for the life of me, but I must have got his sticker about five or six times. I was just thinking, you know, who is this guy? Another one was that one of my best friends in primary school, his mum was Greek, and I remember going around to his house during the tournament, and his dad was telling my mum when she came to pick me up about how he'd been on the phone to his mother-in-law, who also was Greek, and was saying about what was going on with the Euros and about how he'd been watching Greece. And apparently her response was, oh, are we in it? And then basically, I think this was when they just qualified for the semi-finals, and his response was something along the lines of, yeah, you're doing rather well. And obviously we know what happened there. But, yeah, I think those two particularly, slightly contrasting memories. But, yeah, they're the two things that stick out to me.
That's excellent. So I suppose, you know, Stephen, I'll come to you then before, you know, like I said, before we get in here. 2004 is a tournament, you know, all the big European, the big hitters are all at Euro 2004, aren't they?
They are. I mean, I think now that it's rare that any of the big nations don't get there. I mean, it clearly happens. England don't get there in 2008. You know, the Netherlands further down the line even conspiring not to get to a 2014 European Championship. So, but by now, you know, that edge of the qualifiers has been, you know, vastly eroded. So the final tournaments themselves, in a way, gain, you know, a greater focus. Because with the 18 European Championship, you know, you embrace it as almost like a two-year tournament, 18-month tournament, was that the qualifiers had such an edge and such a feeling of vulnerability to them that nations weren't even going to get to the finals. You know, that was taken away by the 16-team tournament, but the 16-team tournament was double the size, but it didn't struggle for it. You know, and I think I expected it to struggle, and it didn't, but this is what made them so strong as a tournament. But yeah, it took away from the qualifiers somewhat.
I mean, you know, Gary, you know, for you, Euro 2004, I mean, obviously we'll work our way through the tournament, and we'll, you know, we'll look at sort of the, like we said, the, you know, the shock of the eventual winners. But when you get sort of all the principal, you know, European sides all qualifying, it kind of like whets the appetite almost. You almost hope for you anticipate it being a classic competition when there's nobody missing that you would like to see there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, buddy. It's interesting that some of the teams that you know, we look on as big fish struggle to qualify. I mean, Spain, we sort of, I'll get onto it, no doubt, shortly. And obviously in 2008, they only qualified via the playoffs. They actually finished behind Greece. Greece topped their group, you know, when they qualified. You know, people will say that Greece were fortunate winners. You know, when we get into the tournament, we'll look at the way the results they had, and, you know, that will be thrown massively into question because they weren't. But as you say, you know, all the big guys were there. And when you get a tournament like this, when there's enough group spaces for all the big teams to be there, then you know you're going to get a quality tournament. And you know, there were some cracking games in that. And, you know, a lot of teams could sort of plead their cases of being unlucky losers. But, you know, as I say, when we get into the tournament, the results, and we'll look at how well Greece did, you know, they were deserved winners of the tournament.
I mean, you know, I'll come back to you, James. And, you know, obviously, well, as Gary's mentioned, you know, talked about Spain, and funnily enough, you know, it's Greece that splits Portugal and Spain, you know, in the final group standings. But, you know, even the fact that the tournament's held in Portugal draw Spain in Group A, you know, and sort of right from the offset, you have you know, just in Group A, you have what we'll hope will be this classic tournament, and then, you know, sort of one of the first games in, and, you know, and Greece are defeating the host Portugal 2-1, and it almost sort of set the tone almost for the tournament. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Greece sort of surprisingly went along the way, but, you know, sort of when you open with a, you know, a victory over the host nation, it, you know, people, I suppose, maybe should have taken a bit more notice early on.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the thing is that before that, Greece obviously had never achieved anything of note in international football. And I think even though you do have surprising results, I mean, you look 2 years before in the World Cup with what happened to France against Senegal. I mean, obviously that ended in a slightly worse way for the French than it did the Portuguese. They still managed to reach the final, I guess. But I think that it's definitely, you know, some tournaments you need a few games to get going. I think, you know, it's a cliche, but often in tournaments, teams that do well in the group stage, you need to have that kind of momentum built up over time where you keep playing better game by game, you know, and you get better as the tournament progresses. And I think slow starts, you know, they're not uncommon in international tournaments. I think certainly for Portugal, you know, I'm sure we'll get on to the quality they had in their team and the fact this was billed as, you know, some sort of a golden generation. I think, yeah, definitely losing at home to Greece was a surprise. But I think it's something that, as I say, you know, we've mentioned Greece were deserved winners. You look at the way they played and the way they set up. They had a game plan which was, yeah, everybody knew their role in the team. It was very well drilled, what they were going to do, how they were going to play. And I think, yeah, as you say, from the opening game, it really did have all the makings of a classic tournament.
And you're right, and you hope for these tournaments, you know, you hope that they kick off with, you know, like you say, a great start or a great game, or maybe, you know, maybe an unexpected result. But, I mean, coming to you, Stephen, and we mentioned right at the beginning, you know, about the sort of the top teams qualifying. But then you look at teams that didn't actually qualify from the group once they got there, and you had Spain, a very good Croatian side, Italy, Germany. Now, four separate groups, you know, all of them failing to make the quarterfinals. You know, I suppose it partly shows that the strength of the European Championships as a competition, but, you know, you can argue that sometimes European Championships can maybe find teams out that are either in transition, or, you know, it can be the pinnacle of some European sides where their very best versions of themselves actually arrive.
Yeah, completely. I think, you know, you can look at Group D, for instance, you know, yeah, Latvia in there, which was always going to be interesting anyway, but as soon as you draw like the Czech Republic, the Netherlands and Germany into a group, you know, you're automatically drawn to it because you know that, like, there's going to be a, you know, a big nation that's not going to go through. And they do, they just catch their eye, the hypnotic, and any weakness is going to be exposed. You know, with the European Championships, so much more notorious than the World Cup for the need to get off to a, you know, a good starter, you know, lose that first game, and there's a massive danger of you not going through, because every game it tends to be quite massive, and for Portugal to lose that opening game was a really big kind of like sit up and notice. It was, I think, probably the most shocking opening game to a major tournament since Cameroon had beaten Argentina, you know, in the 1990 World Cup. You know, it was a proper kind of like moment, because as James said, you know, Greece had no, you know, track record for this before. You know, they really hadn't. They'd qualified for Euro 80, not done all that great. Didn't do badly, but, you know, they didn't leave a lasting impression. In the 94 World Cup, they were quite abject, but here they were, upsetting. And that's the great thing about the European Championships, is that you can find yourself in a group where, yes, there's a perceived lesser light, but if they put it together to go through, then yes, again, there's another big side that's going to drop out, because, you know, if you are perceived to be the weak link in a group but you go through, then somewhere along the line a stronger link is going out. Exactly what happens here. Spain, out they go. you know, and you can point to Group C in the same light, is that Italy didn't make it through. Italy, such a massive thing at international tournaments for me, because you can set your watch by them. They're either going to go all the way or close, or they're going to fall flat on the face in the group stages. It's one or the other, and whichever version of Italy show up, it's guaranteed entertainment. But on the other side of everything, Germany were the team to go out in the group stages here that were of a big nature, but they were still a team in, I don't know, a transition possibly isn't the right word. I think the people probably thought they were in decay at the time. Euro 2000, they played badly. Euro 2004, they went out at the group stages. And the 2002 team that got to the World Cup was one of the worst, possibly the worst European side to reach a World Cup final. And yeah, they were the classic side to be found out in this tournament. But it just lent this great entertainment to us all.
I suppose, you know, coming to you, Gary, and I know, you know, we will go through some of the groups, you know, and Steve, you know, Stephen's pointed out, you know, about Italy and Germany and so on, you know, and obviously there's, you know, Croatia and England's group who, you know, we sort of expected to do well. But just coming back to sort of Group A, and, you know, you have this classic encounter at the end where Spain are playing Portugal, you know, both teams needing a positive result to get through, you know, and Portugal, you know, defeat Spain, and, you know, Greece lose to Russia in that final game, yet still go through, and, you know, and obviously Spain are going out on goal difference. But I suppose, you know, like we said at the beginning, this is what you want from your international tournaments. You want jeopardy in those final group games. And when it's such close rivalries, you know, such between Spain and Portugal, and Portugal having lost to Greece in that opening game, you know, there must have been immense pressure on a home nation or a host nation in that particular fixture.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, it wasn't goal difference. It was because Greece had actually scored more goals. The goal difference was identical.
Sorry, yeah.
But Greece had scored more goals. But yeah, I mean, I actually was in a bar in Calpe watching the game, that Spain-Portugal game. Now, you know, it's not England-Scotland, but it's not far off. There's a lot of Iberian rivalry between Spain and Portugal, and, you know, and Spain didn't have a bad team. And, you know, look at the results before they played that game. They beat Russia in the opening game, so that set them nicely. They drew with Greece. Now, that doesn't sound great, but when you say, OK, they drew with the European champions, that's not a bad result. And then they've got Portugal to play in the last game. Now, one of those teams are going to go out unless there's a massive amount of goals scored in it. And, you know, Portugal got the job done, but it was a real tense game. It wasn't a free-flowing game. You know, two teams who both played, you know, really decent football, but that game was really close and tense, and it was very bitty, and I won't say niggly, but it wasn't far short of that. And, you know, eventually the Portuguese got through, and, you know, Spain, as they've done so many times in the past, they fell by the wayside. And, you know, as Stevie was mentioned earlier, when a team like, unexpected team like Greece qualify, a big guy's going out, and in this case, Spain suffered.
I mean, I suppose, you know, we're going to have to come to England, you know, at some point, James. And, you know, this was a, you know, quite a talented England side that Sven-Göran Eriksson took to this competition. And I, you know, even as a fan myself, you know, as a football fan, and, you know, my interest in England sort of goes in peaks and troughs, if you like. But, you know, even I had some managed, but higher than usual expectations is probably the best way to describe it. But I mean, that was a talented England side that went to that tournament.
Well, it was, yeah. I mean, I think that's just reminded me another thing that I had as, you know, pointless memorabilia that you have at the bottom of the drawer now. I had some coins that Sainsbury's released of all of the team. And I remember, I think I kept getting David James in that. I seem to have this ability to get lots of swaps of the goalkeepers. But yeah, I mean, you think of that team, it was, I'd probably say, better than the England team that got to the semi-finals of the World Cup 2 years ago, on paper, certainly. I mean, obviously, there's the conundrum of being able to fit Lampard, Gerrard and Scholes into a team, which, you know, sort of 15 years later, no one's really come up with a solution for. But I think, yeah, I mean, obviously you had Michael Owen being in the form that he was in, Wayne Rooney just burst onto the scene. You know, Ferdinand and Terry, there wasn't a much better centre-back pairing in Europe. So, yeah, I think everyone did have quite rightly high expectations. I think that certainly if you were to look at England's performances at tournaments over the past 20 years or so, I'd probably say that Euro 2004 was the biggest disappointment in terms of the squad that was available. Obviously, you look at, you know, what happened against Iceland 12 years later, but the team there was nowhere near the level that went to the Euros in 2004.
I mean, you know, Stephen, you know, your opinion on that England side. I mean, you know, we've not really mentioned France much yet, but, you know, I mean, going into injury time, England were leading that opening game against France, you know, 1-0, and, you know, it's you know, everything seemed really positive, and, you know, and England do turn it around in the next two group games. But, you know, we came so close to defeating France in that opening game. There was a real, although it set back, but there was a real belief that this was a side that could go, you know, quite far into an international tournament.
Yeah, this was a very good England side. It was the best that Ericsson took to a major tournament, as far as I'm concerned. They were quite a balanced side. James is right, that perennial, you know, juggling around of trying to fit so many good midfielders into a midfield system like that. You know, Lampard, Gerrard, Scholes. If that's Italy, one of the three does not play, you know, a difficult decision is made. Beckham, yes, he could go out and play on the right-hand side. So, you know, it was a role that he could go and play. He wasn't necessarily playing that role anymore at club level, but it was where he'd come from. So that wasn't a problem. But, yeah, you know, I think that's probably the only thing that England did wrong in that major tournament, in that European Championship, was to get the balance just not quite right. To make one, there were probably one brave decision away from reaching the far reaches of that tournament, for my money. And yeah, that France game, they at the very least match France. You know, it was a brilliant France side. At the very least, they went toe-to-toe for them. And if they'd have won 1-0, they'd have deserved to have won 1-0. The way that France came back so late in it, yeah, quite heartbreaking for them, really. But I think the great thing about it was that it didn't destroy England's confidence. They still went out and played with a great freedom. You know, you look at the players in that side, and that Steven Gerrard had missed the 2002 World Cup through injury. So he was really, really up for this tournament. Frank Lampard hadn't made the squad in 2002. Again, he was really, really up for it. You know, the Wayne Rooney factor, just through that quintessential kind of unknown into a tournament situation for England, in a way that harks back to kind of like Paul Gascoigne at the 1990 World Cup, that complete and utter playing for joy of the football, enjoying yourself, being young enough for it not to be the weight of the world as well. And England had everything going for them, absolutely everything going for them in that tournament. It is what I class them as. I look at tournaments and think that there were nations that could have won it. You know, you have your ultimate winner, but, you know, we'll look back at 82 and say, yes, Italy won it, but it could have been Brazil, it could have been France, it could have even been Poland. You know, there's always other candidates, and England were a decent candidate for this. And, I mean, I fully believe that England tend to go out of major tournaments where they deserve to go out of major tournaments, but this is one of those exceptions.
You know, I mean, Gary, you know, I'm interested in your opinion. You know, you're a very passionate England fan. And I'm so, you know, I suppose the impact of Wayne Rooney on this particular tournament, and, you know, and you could argue that, you know, maybe never achieved the heights in a major international tournament as he did in this one.
Yeah, I mean, I always have this massive problem with the Scholes, Lampard, Gerrard issue. For God's sake, there are three outstanding footballers. You know, we need a manager to make them play together. And I'm sorry, but I think they can play together. And if they can't, the manager needs his ass kicking. because talent like that, I can't believe we can't make it work. I remember when Mourinho was at Chelsea and he wanted to sign Gerrard from Lampard from Liverpool, and he needed came and he didn't. And people say Lampard and Gerrard couldn't play together. Jose Mourinho would have made Gerrard and Lampard play together, and it would have been wonderful for England. So, I mean, I always have this sort of problem with, you know, it's a problem having these great players. It's not a bloody problem. It's a fantastic opportunity. And in that group, England scored 8 goals. They should have beat France. Sudan scored twice. I think it was something a back pass for the first goal in injury time. It was a crazy penalty later on. But England should have topped that group without a problem. The main issue they had, what stunted their progress, was Rooney's injury. Rooney was absolutely on fire in that tournament. It was his coming out party. And later against, I think it was the Croatia game, and he got injured. And basically, that took all the wind out of England's sails. And I don't think England deserved to go out of there. And I think, as Steve said quite rightly, I think England were massive contenders to win that tournament. With the players they had, it was, you know, the golden generation is always a bit of a, you know, a sad cliche about football teams, but they're an outstanding crop of players there. And you know, we lost Rooney, and we had no disrespect to him, but Dennis Vassell, come on, it ain't the same thing. It ain't even close. It ain't even the same street. But that was what cost England. It wasn't the not being able to play Gerrard and Lampard and Scholes in the same group team. That's what cost England losing Rooney.
I mean, you know, James, obviously, like you say, you know, this is your first sort of major tournament. And I suppose, you know, it was sort of a welcome introduction to probably the disappointment and hope that us older guys have carried for a long time with regards to England. But before we move on to Greece, just your opinion, James, on the England side going into it as your sort of first major international tournament. How did you find watching England at a major tournament for the first time?
Well, I mean, it was a bit strange, to be honest with you, Stu, because the thing is, where I live in North Wales, it's right on the border with England. So I went to school in England. So all of my classmates were English and were obviously wanting England to do well. And I was kind of there, as I say, I was sort of getting my head around organisation of football and stuff. And I kind of found out that Wales hadn't qualified because of what happened in the qualifiers against Russia in the playoffs. So I was a little bit disappointed about that, but I do remember watching the games. Yeah, I remember watching particularly the quarterfinal against Portugal. I remember as well, it's quite vivid now because it's so long ago, but I seem to remember as well when England played France. I remember my dad going to one of his friend's houses. It's not a particularly interesting story, but that's all I really remember of England at that tournament. It was more other teams that I remember more strongly because of how they performed. But, yeah, I mean, I think, as I said before, and as we've mentioned, that England team and the ability that was within it, I think a lot of people going into the tournament quite rightly were optimistic.
You know, we've reached one quarterfinal, and I'm quite interested. Although, you know, we'll talk about the final in a little while. But once we hit the sort of the quarterfinal stage, Greece then embark on this 1-0 mantra, if you like, that takes them all the way to the final. I don't know. I mean, obviously, we'll all discuss Greece as winners and where their legacy sits with regards to that. But, you know, Stephen said France. You know, France were a good side. It was a good French side that went to that tournament, and yet, you know, Greece. You know, it's 1-0, and you know, and France are by the wayside, and Greece are all of a sudden in the semi-finals. And like I say, with all the best will in the world, you know, as we mentioned, this is Greece's first sort of qualification at a major tournament. Is a, you know, is a real shock, having been in a group with Portugal and Spain, having drawn France in the quarterfinals. It starts to not become a fluke, if that makes sense.
I think definitely. I mean, you only have to look at the fact that they won all of their knockout games and the final 1-0 to see that there was a lot more at stake here than just Greece getting lucky. You know, in terms of the way that they played, it was obviously they set up with the sort of three centre-backs, which I think that was particularly key, especially for the France game, because obviously you had Henri up front, you had David Trezeguet, And you had, the way they played, there was always, out of Dabizas, Delas and Capsis, there was always one man free to, you know, almost act as a sweeper and get the ball away. And I think the way that they set up was very much organised. You know, I mean, you can't really look past the fact that it was a defensive sort of style, but in terms of the results it got, you can't really argue with it, can you?
No, you can't. Like you said, by the time we get to the final, it absolutely speaks for itself. Stephen, I just want to touch on a side that I'm pretty sure you're going to have strong opinions on and enjoy talking about, and that's the Czech Republic side that sort of, I suppose if you like, almost sweep, you know, progress unnoticed, but very serenely, very calmly through the competition. You know, it's a comfortable 3-0, you know, quarterfinal victory. You know, it's a very, very good Czech Republic side. You know, and all of a sudden you have, you know, two of your semi-finalists are Greece and the Czech Republic, and that's no disrespect to the Czech Republic, but probably not who you would have selected at the start of the tournament based on who'd qualified as one of the final four.
Yeah, completely. The Czech Republic were just brilliant at this tournament. You know, from playing Latvia and struggling in a way. They came from one down in that opening game, Latvia's first game at a major international tournament, massively enthusiastic for it, as they would be. Play a team like that, you know, last in your group, not first. But then once they'd navigated that, people tend to forget that they were two down against the Netherlands in the second group game and turned it around for this epic 3-2 win that they snatched kind of like 2 minutes from time. And Barros just kind of like lit up their team. And Jan Koller was the other one, who looked more like a heavyweight boxer than he did a footballer. That knucklehead, you know, without a shred of hair on it. And, you know, he just looked scurry, but he could play. You know, he was one of these real oddities that physically just looked like a target man at best. Your expectations just looking at him would have to be quite low. He'd be a functional type of player. You know, he's a target man. He wouldn't look out of place in a 1980s Wimbledon side. But that's just on physical appearance. But then once he started to play, he could use the ball brilliantly. You know, he had such great close control, you know, intelligence. He kind of encapsulated an old-style centre-forward because he could do all of those, you know, meat and potato things, the holding up of the ball, the laying off. But then, you know, he could run at players with the ball at his feet. And then he had the physical presence to be able to get to a cross, and he was one of the most underrated players of his generation. Really, he goes largely forgotten, and Barros just kind of like absolutely, you know, benefited from his presence there. You know, with no collar, you know, Barros does not do what he does throughout that tournament, and they have this fantastic mix of the physical, the hard working and then the skilled, you know, and Smicha was fantastic in that tournament as well. You know, there was just a magical kind of link between the players there. As we spoke earlier about a team just pulling it all together at the right time. And the fact that the Czech Republic just had this wonderful propensity to do so well at European Championships and then be so abject at World Cups, it was almost like they'd exhaust themselves at a European Championship and they need to recoup and to rest through a failed World Cup qualifying campaign and then rise again for the European Championships. There was just this brilliant mad oddity about them, but you know, they for me, along with England, were the best two teams in the tournament.
I mean, you know, so you know, coming to you, Gary, it's, you know, obviously your boys are in, you know, are in one of the other quarterfinals, you know, against Sweden. It's, you know, the Netherlands 0, Sweden 0, you know, and so they make up the semi-finalists. And again, the Netherlands, you know, the Netherlands go out in the semi-final to the hosts, Portugal. This talented Czech Republic side go out to, Greece, you know, again 1-0, like we said, and looking at that semi-final lineup, you would have thought it would have been a Dutch Czech Republic final, and you know, and that would have been it. But we end up with this Portugal Greece final that's, you know, slightly unexpected, albeit hosts. But you know, I suppose two things briefly. You know, the Netherlands. Do you think it was a missed opportunity for them?
It was a classic Greek team. Sorry, forgive me. It wasn't a classic Dutch team. I mean, they had players like Robben, Van Nistelrooy. But you know, when we look back at the vintage of, you know, Van Basten, Roy Card, Hullet, or going back even further, you know, Cruyff, Hoeskins, it wasn't a classic Dutch team. I mean, don't get me wrong, they weren't rubbish, but you know, they weren't the outstanding team there. I mean, just sort of looking at the results as you were talking to Stevie, I mean, the French team that the Greeks beat, this is a team that had Trezeguet and Henri in front. In midfield, they had Pires, Makélélé, and Zidane. You know, this, you know, when the Greeks beat these guys, you know, that was no weak French team that they beat. And you know, I'm always interested. You know, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, I've said so many times on podcast, you know, my idea of football is the way the Dutch play total football. It's the beautiful game. But the Greeks had a way. Otto Rehhagel, you know, he deserves massive credit. He looked at the players he'd got and he set his system up that would work. And you know, okay, it wasn't the prettiest thing in the world, but you know, they knew how to play it and they got the job done. And I'm always a great sort of defender of teams that sort of have a way. They're not the best technically, but they know how to get the job done. It's a bit like Wimbledon used to be when they were in the Premier League. People say, oh, it's rubbish football. Well, my argument is, if it's rubbish, beat it. You know, if you can't beat it, it's not rubbish by definition. You know, and you know, people are sort of castigate the Greeks for winning bad dogging wings at 1-0, and big guy up front and scores goals, and you know, and then they defend like, you know, like bloody hell. And fair enough, if it's crap, beat it. But no, in this tournament, nobody could. Not even the French team that had the quality there. And you know, look, moving further forward to the semi-finals, and when they played the Czech Republic. As Stevie mentioned earlier, a classic Czech Republic team. If Greece had batted crap, beat it. The Czechs couldn't beat it either. You know, so massive kudos to Rehhagel for setting his team up to win the tournament with a team that, if anybody, without looking now, could name one player in that Greek team, or I mean, probably Zakarakis, but aside from that, can name two players out of that Greek team. You could probably name out of the Czech Republic, out of the Dutch, out of the French, out of the Portuguese, out of the Spanish, but not the team that won it.
Yeah, it is one of those great things. And to be fair, it leads us on. You know, James, you know, I'm going to ask you all about, you know, sort of about the final, I guess. But, you know, you get first crack here, James. What do you think is the legacy of that Greek side?
I mean,
that
certainly
won this
influenced
tournament?
A lot of people that I was playing football with growing up. I can't tell you the amount of people who had Greek shirts with Karisteas on the back. When I was younger, it was ridiculous. That always seemed to be the player everyone had as well. It was never sort of Karagounis or anyone else. It was just always Karisteas. But I think in terms of the legacy, I think it just shows that anything is possible in football. I think, you know, we've discussed it, that this, whilst it was a very good Greek team, in terms of individual talent, there was nobody in there was really anywhere near the level of, you know, that they should have been in terms of winning European championships. I mean, you look at the players in there individually, none of them had particularly wonderful careers. I mean, I think Nikos Davizas had been relegated with Leicester, you know, just a few sort of months before. So the overall makeup of the team really wasn't there. But I think it shows that if you work as a collective and you all follow your instructions that the manager gives you, you are capable of achieving an awful lot more than, you know, you would if you were just an individualistic team.
I absolutely agree with that. You know, it sort of echoes what Gary said. Coming to you, Stephen, sort of last word for you on this tournament. Portugal as hosts, do you think not saying the occasion was too big for them, that sounds awful and quite a glib thing to say, but was it? I don't know how else to word it, I'm really sorry.
I think the man, yeah.
You know, do you think that That moment was too big.
I think the expectation of it was too much for them. You know, the two-year build-up of friendlies and the fact that they'd hired Scolari to see them through it. And there was a massive amount of expectation. I think they were surprised to get the tournament in the first place. Spain, with the, you know, the smart money was on Spain. I think it seems to remember there was massive, genuine shock when Spain weren't allotted Euro 2004 and that Portugal got it instead. And I'm sure that was mirrored in Portugal itself. And yeah, then to have this build-up and the pressure then, because it was, as being mentioned, the golden generation, with an added Cristiano Ronaldo in there as well. And each passing tournament, to some that they didn't even qualify for, they contrived not to qualify for some major tournaments, was that the expectation had been that Portugal would, this Portugal generation would eventually win something or get to the final. And they didn't, and it just wouldn't happen. And to lose that opening game against Greece probably did them a favour, in the long run, because they did improve, to have that huge game against Spain where they needed to win to get through, and then to get past England in the quarterfinals, which we all, even I put my hands up and say that was a very, very good England side, and to ride out the drama of it, the 2-2, to concede the late equaliser, to go into the penalty shootout, and to see that through, and then to beat the Netherlands. I think people start to forget just what they went through to get that far. And Gary's right, it wasn't a classic Netherlands side. It was a functional Netherlands side, led by a functional coach in Dick Advocaat. That Dutch side probably have more in common with Greece than they did with Portugal in many ways, is that the philosophy was to do the pragmatic things and to do them well. Yes, the Netherlands had far superior players than Greece did, but there was a similar approach to the way that Otto Rehhagel and Dick Advocaat approached the tournament and set their teams out. And for me, Portugal probably deserved to get to the final. I think if someone sat there and just looked at them in cold, hard terms, they actually got better as the tournament went on, especially once they got past the group stages.
Gary, the last question for you, and I, judging by your previous comments, I think I probably know the answer, but did the right team win it?
They won it. So, and I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that. I knew that's what you'd say. I've written it down here. Gary will say the right team won it because they won it.
It's one of those, essential facts. But if you were a Portuguese player before the tournament started and said, OK, guys, here's the final coming up, you've got Greece in the final, they'd have snapped your hand off. This is a Portuguese team that, as Stevie said, they had the golden generation, they had Figo, they had Rui Costa, they had Deco, they had Cristiano Ronaldo. In defence, they had Carvalho and Ferreira, who were ripping things up for Chelsea in the Premier League. A fantastic team. Yet again, somebody couldn't get the job done against the Greek team. I remember the final massively when I was in that bar next to the hotel when I was in Spain, and the guy, the patron of the bar, celebrated massively when Greece scored, because obviously Portugal had dumped Spain into the competition. I can't tell you the sort of stats of it, whether Greece had more possession or Portugal had more possession or they had more play in the other half of the field. It don't matter. It doesn't, because the only stat that matters is, the one, when you're watching TV, to the top, it's on the scoreboard or it's in your mind when you're watching the game live. It's the goals that count, and Greece had a system that worked for the players they had. They applied that system methodically, effectively, and they won the tournament.
It is, you're right, and it's a great way to end, sort of our chat on 2004 and into 2008. And I suppose straight away, James, without skipping to the end, which I'm going to skip to the end of this question, but obviously we'll go through the tournament. But in terms of contrast of winners, James, between 2004 and 2008, I guess you can't really get much different.
Certainly, you just look at, in terms of the names, I mean, Greece compared to Spain already is, you know, a massive difference. But yeah, in terms of the way they played, obviously we discussed the way that the Greek team was very functional, but yeah, the Spanish team played some lovely football. Obviously, it's the birth of, yeah, I mean, I don't want this entire podcast to be talking about golden generations, but yeah, it's the entire birth of that wonderful Spain team and just the way that they played. And everyone, you know, we're talking about the Greek team, and besides Karasteas and Karagounis, if you ask the average person on the street, well, I mean, there's no one on the street at the moment, but yeah, if you ask the average person, they can't really name anyone else, but they can probably give you 8, 9, maybe the entire team for Spain in that tournament, because it's just so memorable the way that they played and the players they had inside it.
It is, and like I say, we will go through this, and we'll, you know, we'll work our way back to the final, and we'll discuss Spain. But Stephen, I'm going to come to you because I think you might have something to say on this. But obviously, first, we've got to start with England, you know, failing to qualify.
And again, such a good team. You know, how did they fail to qualify there? I think there was it a defeat in Russia. Then it was Pavlyuchenko springs to mind. You know, and Croatia. So yeah, they were involved in a difficult group there. That was the rise of a good Russia, and Russia would prove how good they were when they got to itself. But yeah, that was an England side that, given that two teams will qualify from it, was pretty epic. And that failure on the final night in the rain at Wembley, new Wembley not long having opened as well. Was it, you know, McLaren there with the brolly and stuff like that? You know, it just smacked of abjectness. You know, was it Scott Carson who played that night with the error that he made? And there was just these, you know, fundamental errors of choice. It wasn't that the team were particularly bad. It was a team littered with great names. And in a way, it had a similarity to kind of like Kevin Keegan's time in charge of England. You look at the players that were under, you know, his wing there. Just what was he thinking with the way that he put them together, the way that he sent them out, the way they played?
I mean, you know, Gary, you know, you've written a book on the England team, albeit, you know, at the World Cups, but there's always, and I suppose it must be the same in, you know, whichever nation you come from, you know, and you support them, and there's always it just feels like there's something missing in a tournament when your nation doesn't qualify.
I mean, you know, who am I, he says, sitting here with a glass of water talking about football with his mates. You know, I've never managed a football team other than, you know, under 14s, under 16s and such like, when I've done a coaching badges. But England have this appalling record of picking the wrong manager. No disrespect to Steve McLaren, who I'm sure he's a very nice guy, nice to small furry animals and old people. But, you know, and an exceptional good club manager. But the international stage wasn't his situation. The same was true of Graham Taylor. Exceptional good club manager. International stage wasn't his arena. And Roy Hodgson, you could say the same about him. And if you look at the successful international teams, they don't necessarily pick managers from clubs that have been successful. Some do, but you know, I mean, Beckenbauer won the World Cup as a coach, never managed a club team in his life. You don't have to. When you're managing players who have played at international level, you don't need to teach them the basics. I mean, for God's sake, to play international football, they know these sort of things anyway. It's you set your formation, you set your tactics, and you inspire. And that's pretty much it, I guess. You pick your players. You know, Southgate's had real success for England. As a club manager, he was pretty well bang ordinary. He did well with Middlesbrough. But, you know, I mean, he didn't win the title. He won Alex Ferguson or Arsene Wenger. So England has this massive problem with picking managers who have been successful with clubs and then don't make... Tom Revie, another good example. So for me, the problem with England was that we had a manager who wasn't up to the job. And I say that's no disrespect to Steve McLaren, who was, you know, far more qualified than I will ever be. But I'm a football fan and I'm an England fan, and, you know, I pay my money, so I'm going to have my opinion. You know, that's the situation. We should have qualified from that group. You know, OK, Russia were a decent team, as Stevie said, and when they qualified for the tournament, they did well then. So were Croatia. But England still had a quality crop of players and should have qualified from that group.
I agree.
It's an interesting point of the qualification. I mean, I don't know if anybody's looked this up, but if you haven't, I bet you won't know the answer. So I'll ask each of you, you know, who was the top scorer in the qualifying tournament? It's all gone quiet over there, as they say.
I don't need to take part. I'm the host.
I'd be interested if you can even add the country we played for. He scored 13 of his country's 17 goals in the qualifying tournament.
Not a clue. Not a clue. There'll be someone who scored like 12 goals against.
No. His team didn't even qualify. It was David Healy of Northern Ireland.
You see, Gary, this is why, you see, this is... It's all right saying you've not managed at international level, but it's stuff like that.
It's interesting, just moving on, well, on the qualification, that the difference it made having two teams qualify from bigger groups as well, because a lot of teams that sort of may have sort of linked into playoffs actually qualified as right. And it's also worth mentioning that the European champions, Greece, topped their qualifying group by 7 points. They played 12 games, won 10, drew one, lost one. So they weren't a bad team, were they, really?
It's funny. I mean, it links in quite nicely, actually. I'm going to go to James, but you know, starting off with, you know, this was a tournament that was hosted by Switzerland and Austria, and sort of conversely, Austria don't get out of the group, Switzerland don't get out of the group, Greece making even though Gary just mentioned they're a great side, but Greece make an abject attempt at sort of defending their title, finish bottom with 0 points. You know, and I suppose, James, if you're with Portugal, as we talked about in 2004, you know, they get to the final, and, you know, you need a host nation to do well in order for it to generate some sort of momentum in the tournament. But when you have co-hosts, I suppose you've got twice the chance, but when both sides go out in the group stages, it can sometimes affect the tournament.
I think so,
can't
it? I mean, I think if you look at this tournament in particular, the Austria team was not really anything of any note whatsoever. And I mean, Switzerland always have a team that are kind of, they're decent, they're functional, but they're never, you never expect them to do much other than get out of the group stage and maybe get to, if it's a World Cup, get to the quarterfinals at a push. But I think normally it does make a tournament, it does kind of dampen the excitement around it, you know. Even though in 2002, South Korea, very questionable what happened and how they managed to get to the semi-finals. But I think having a host nation and just seeing the home fans, because, you know, there's just that added bit of excitement watching their own team. I mean, it doesn't necessarily even need to be qualification. I mean, you look at what happened in the World Cup in 2010, just South Africa's goal against Mexico. I mean, that alone will live with me for most of my life, to be honest. That's one of my defining football memories, that goal in the opening game from Sabalala. But I think, yeah, if you look at this tournament, it was quite fortunate in the sense that there was drama from elsewhere. And that whilst it was a shame that Switzerland and Austria didn't manage to get as far as, you know, even get out of the group, it was kind of sublimated by having other teams that you wouldn't have expected to do much, you know, the likes of Turkey and Russia, as we'll get on to, going as far as they did.
It is, and like you say, we will get onto those sides, but I suppose, you know, Stephen, one more nation that probably, capitulated quite dramatically in the group stage. And I suppose, you know, we talked about in 2004, like you said, when you get three big teams. And in Group C, you had the Netherlands, Italy, Romania, but also France. So like you say, one of those big three aren't going to make it. But France were poor. Poor in that tournament, they get 1 point, and it's a 0-0 draw against Romania.
This is probably the start of the France era, where, although maybe it started 2 years earlier, was they took on that mantle of how the Netherlands always used to fall apart in an aesthetic sense, that there would be internal rows and discord and arguments, and it'll either be between, you know, factions within the playing squad itself, or the coach that wasn't wanted by the players, and there was always a team, one team or another, at the very least, that would hit the self-destruct button before they'd even kick the ball. And this was France, you know, this was France, and to be drawn into the group they were, and that was no bad Romania side as well. That was a decent Romania side that came quite close to qualifying for the knockout stages. I think it was. Was it a late, quite a late goal in one of the games at the very least, I think, that sprang to mind. They actually played quite well. They were compact. You know, they went for the pragmatism. So they made themselves difficult, and they themselves put themselves into the mix of things with a game to play. But, France were just absolutely abject. And it's that, like we'd said with 2004... You know, if a team is drawn into a group like that and something internally is going wrong, then they're going to get found out and they're going to fall out of the tournament. And this was France, and to be doing this so close after such a brilliant era of French football as well. Even within this period of discord, you know, they'd got to the World Cup final in 2006. You know, it was 2002 that they'd not done so great at the World Cup, but then 2004 under Santini that they changed the ethic. You know, like Gary said, so many nations don't turn to a club to procure a coach, but France did with Santini in 2004. But then they went back to the tried and trusted inner sanctum and the inner circle of Clairefontaine and changed it up again. There's just something badly remiss about France, and it was so not like France as well.
I know exactly what you mean coming off the back of that success. But in terms of, I suppose for you, Gary, I just want to chat about, you know, James has mentioned Turkey there, and we'll come to Turkey in a second, and you know, we'll chat to James about that as his sort of one of his specialisms, one of his favourite areas to talk about. But the Russians as well, they were a good Russian side, but they're a side that make it all the way to the semi-finals, and they're a side that I seem to be drawn to the Netherlands with you, Gary. I'm really sorry. But they're a side that dispatched the Dutch, albeit in extra time, but, you know, dispatched the Dutch sort of 3-1 in the quarterfinals. And, you know, again, it's almost like a going back. I mean, this is the fifth episode now, but Russia, and before that as the Soviet Union, always seem to have done well in this particular competition.
You're absolutely right. We've obviously covered it in the early episodes, and the European Championship was very much at the exclusive confines of the Eastern European countries, but they were very prominent, and certainly Russia were a decent side in this tournament. I mean, they got, back in the first game, they got beat by the Spanish 4-1, but then they recovered and got through, and Pavlyuchenko, as Stephen mentioned, was a big player for them in this tournament. They beat the European champions, Greece, who, as you say, after qualifying top of their group, they fell apart in the tournament, and the magic had gone. And when you got to the knockout stages as well, Russia was were I won't say faster, more successful. They went to extra time against the Dutch. But you know, before that game, the Dutch would probably fancy the chances, and it was only a late Van Nistelrooy goal, probably 3 or 4 minutes from time, if I remember serves me right, that they got them into extra time, and then they lost 3-1 in the end, and it would be a difficult argument to say that the Dutch were unfortunate to lose because simply put, they weren't, and Russia qualified and knocked them out because they were the better team.
like I say, I mean, you know, coming to you, James, and I suppose, you know, Turkey, the other, you know, real surprise, I suppose, surprise package of this tournament, and up to the semi-finals, a lot like Greece in terms of, you know, nobody expected them, and yet they kept progressing, you know, until they sort of finally meet Germany in the semi-finals, and it's a close game. You know, it's a close game in that semi-final, and you know, and Turkey almost made that step across to the final, but just fall short.
I think the thing with Turkey in an international tournament is you really have no idea what the hell's going to happen with them. I mean, obviously, 6 years before they've got to the semis of the World Cup in 2002, which, you know, nobody saw coming. I mean, before that, they hadn't been to a World Cup since 1954, so it had been an extremely long wait. And Turkey at the Euros previously, they'd never really done anything at all. I mean, Euro 96 was the first time they qualified, and they lost all of their games, and Rushdu in particular was famed for making a couple of errors where he basically just, I think it was against Croatia, he basically just ran out of the goal and left it completely unguarded, and that was one of the losses. And then Euro 2000, they did all right, but again, they didn't manage to make it out of the group. And the tournament we've just discussed, the reason Latvia were there was they'd managed to beat Turkey 3-2 on aggregate in the playoff, which, as you can imagine, caused quite a few angry reactions in Istanbul. But yeah, I mean, this Turkey team, it wasn't a great Turkish team. I mean, you look at the players that you had in there. I mean, Arda Turan was just kind of starting to make his way and really start to make his name with Galatasaray. You have Nihat in there, of course, the sort of famous, you know, frontman for Real Sociedad and Villarreal. But there wasn't really anyone in there besides that. It was just mostly a domestically based squad, and most of the football they played wasn't wonderful. It was mainly, the reason they got so far was mainly just late goals. I mean, they lost 2-0 to Portugal in the opening game, and then Switzerland was quite an interesting one, because Turkey played Switzerland previously, a couple of years before, to qualify. It was a qualifier for the World Cup in 2006. Switzerland won on away goals, and then the final whistle, Fatih Terim, the manager, basically just, I don't know why, he told his players to just chase after the Swiss team. There's a very funny video on YouTube of the Turkish team basically just chasing the Swiss players off the pitch. And there was a fight in the tunnel. Quite a few players got banned for several games. So that game had a lot of, in the group stage, obviously with Switzerland hosting, had a lot of questions being asked around it. Turkey managed to win that because of a late goal from Arda Turan. And then the other two games before they went out to Germany in the semis, again, they were very fortunate, really, to beat the Czech Republic. I mean, that team that we mentioned from the finals in Portugal, it was kind of coming towards the end of its glory days. You know, Nedved and Rzitski and people like that were kind of, not so much Rzitski, but Nedved and Koller and Galasek, people were getting on a bit. But the Czech Republic were 2-0 up with 15 minutes left, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Arda Turan scores and Nehat scores two in the final couple of minutes, and Turkey wins 3-2 to qualify. And then it was basically the same situation when they played Croatia in the quarterfinals. That was a diabolical game. I remember watching that with my dad and one of my friends, and nothing really happened of any note at all. And then it went all the way through to extra time. Even Klasnic scored with a minute left for Croatia, and you thought, well, that's it. It's Croatia in the semi-finals. And then out of nowhere, Semi Şentürk just gets on the end of a ball from Rushdu. And he's known in Turkey, he's nicknamed the lifeguard because he scores quite a few late goals. And he came up with one there and then went to penalties. And Croatia, I think Croatia missed three of their four penalties. Rushdu ended up saving the penalty and being the hero. He wasn't actually supposed to play. Volkan Demirel was the first choice goalkeeper back there. But I think he's either got suspended or injured. There was some reason he couldn't play. and Rushdu came sort of out of nowhere. By that stage, everyone thought he was past it, and he came back into the fold and made a save from, I think it was Mladen Petric, and then Turkey went through to the semi-finals. And as I say, that they were very unlucky not to beat that German team. I mean, I think overall Germany were the better team on the day, but you know they took the lead. Turkey through Uye Boral, and it was a back and forth game, but it was very watchable from what I remember. I think also, and we spoke about Russia, I think you have to talk about Arshavin in particular. His performances, particularly in this quarterfinals against Holland, he was phenomenal.
You're right, you forget, I suppose sometimes you forget some of these players, like, you know, you just mentioned Arshavin there, and, you know, these players who light up a competition and then, you know, get a move, you know, or what's perceived as a glam move, and, you know, you forget that sometimes players' names are made in major tournaments and not necessarily through watching them in the leagues and then looking forward to in tournaments, but they almost just burst onto the scene from nowhere. And you're right, Arshavin is... You know, he's absolutely one of those players who just sort of bursts onto the scene. But coming to you, Stephen, this Germany side, you know, this is a Germany side that do go all the way to the final, obviously, you know, with that 3-2 victory over Turkey. And, you know, we'll come to Spain in a second to round this off. But, you know, for you, Stephen, where does this Germany side lie? If that makes sense. You know, there are, as much as we've talked about Russia in these previous podcasts, you know, Germany and West Germany, as it was before, have always been a constant presence in this particular tournament, in this particular competition,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think this yeah, tournament validated Germany as being back. You know, they'd hosted the World Cup 2 years earlier, and I think even they, as hosts of the World Cup, didn't expect great things of themselves. No, like we said, they've been pretty poor at the previous two European Championships. They've gone out of the group stages, even lost to a poor England, Keegan's England in 2000. Gone out again in the group stage in 2004. Been massively, massively blessed in the route to the 2002 World Cup final. But then by the time 2006 came around, you know, Germany were kind of seen to be in decay, and the 2006 World Cup was like a big turning point for them, is that the nation just backed them out of kind of like this sense of kind of like, give us something to shout about, give us something to cheer about. They didn't expect to win the tournament, but as the tournament went along, they played, they had this great freedom, there seemed to be a really good aura around the squad. It was led by Klinsmann, who wasn't this great tactician, but he had Jogi Löw alongside him, who was. And then this was this breeding ground for Jogi Löw, the 2006 World Cup, and suddenly this feel-good factor had been delivered to him by Klinsmann. And it was like this perfect progression, really, from the tub-thumping of Klinsmann, this you know, smile put on the face of German football once again, and then he takes over the job. Within 2 years, he's got them back to a major final again in the Euro 2008. And James is right, there was a great deal of fortune in that semi-final against Turkey. You know, Turkey did ride their luck massively for three games on the run, and then seemed to save up the very best football for the semi-final against Germany, and played very. I remember them playing very well in it, and thinking that this is why they've got here. They rode the luck, and then suddenly here they were putting in this real performance of substance, but losing. And it was the opposite way around for Germany. Germany had played well. They'd not scored a huge amount of goals, but they'd done enough, and they'd looked the part. And then through the knockout stages, you know, in the quarterfinal, that was another brilliant kind of forgotten game against Portugal. Where the scorelines kind of massaged a bit because Portugal got a late second goal in a 3-2 defeat. And Germany were there, you know, certainly not out of luck, but this was, you know, a proper kind of Germany aback moment. They didn't get to the final by fluke. It was by design. And this very much felt like you know, the rise of Germany that did have this, you know, downtime. You know, England going there and winning 5-1, you know, for that World Cup qualifier was the result that made them look at themselves and to reevaluate. But Germany being Germany, you know, it wasn't taking them 10, 15, 20 years to come back to the top again to be significant. They were back within 6 years, you know, via a World Cup final that they had no right to get to. It couldn't get any more Germany than that. The bottom of the barrel was the 2006 World Cup final. Absolutely, absolutely bonkers. And then here they are back as a team in a major European Championship final again, as a team of substance. You know, that turnaround was absolutely majestic.
Brilliant. Gary, anything to add on Stephen's interpretation of that, yeah, of that German side?
As ever, Stephen's captured it nicely. You know, they were a team that weren't really fancied, but they just got the job done and kept progressing through. The late goals against Turkey, Lahm's late goal that got them through. And it wouldn't have been the biggest surprise in the world if Germany had won it, because Germany just tend to have that ability to perform in big tournaments. And the recovery they had, and as Stevie said, you know, when they progressed from Klinsmann on to Joachim Löw, in typical German fashion, they progressed. But then in the final, obviously, they came up against a Spain team, which was, you know, and I mentioned earlier about the Dutch weren't a vintage Dutch team. The Spain team were a vintage Spain team. I mean, you look at the players who were there, Casillas was in goal. They had Ramos, Puyol, Iniesta, Xavi, David Silva, David Villa. They had Fernando Torres, and they had the Liverpool Fernando Torres, not the guy that's turned up at Stamford Bridge a few years later and had lost all his talent on the way down the M6 from Liverpool. But, you know, as I say, so you know, the Germany team might have beaten most other teams in that tournament, but it was Spain's year, it was Spain's turn, and we watched the final on a holiday in a town called Rota, which is in Andalusia, not far from Seville. And we were in a bar watching the final, and you can imagine what it was like, pretty raucous. And the guy kept bringing the drinks out, and I think we must have had about 7 or 8 drinks each. And he charged €5 at the end because basically he couldn't care less. And it was, I think, at the same weekend or the weekend after, Nadal won Wimbledon. And the whole place was absolutely going mental. People driving up and down the road with Spanish flags flying out of their cars, and the atmosphere was fantastic because they got over the line. Spain got over the line, and as I say, you know, if it hadn't been Spain, if it hadn't been that Spanish team, nobody in the world would have been surprised if Germany had got the job done.
Yeah. I suppose it's always a nemesis, isn't there? And like you say, I'm sure Germany would have won that tournament, bar the fact that they met Spain in that final. For you, James, the Spain side, is this, you know, I know obviously you're a lot younger than we are. Is this are they the sort of the first great international side that you've seen?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure how much you class the team that won the World Cup in 2006, the Italian side, as a great team. I mean, there was certainly, you could certainly make an argument for it, but I think in terms of memories for myself, definitely this Spain team. I remember sitting and watching the final, and unfortunately, it started off quite a bad record I have watching Euros and World Cup finals, where from the World Cup in 2006 up until the present day, every single final that I've watched, the team I've wanted to win has lost. So I'm not a particularly good omen for the teams in finals. But I definitely remember the final here. It was something that, as I say, I did want Germany to win, but you couldn't really take anything away from this Spanish side. And like you say, you can't really look at it as anything other than a great Spanish side. I mean, obviously what they went on to do 2 years later in South Africa and then retaining the Euros in Poland, Ukraine, it really was a fantastic side. And I mean, I think you've only got to look at the players they had. I mean, some of the players in there as well. I remember Dani Guesa quite strongly, the striker who, I think he was at Mallorca. just before the tournament, because he came to Turkey. Him and Luis Aragonés, the manager, moved to Fenerbahce after the tournament, and neither of them did particularly well. But, yeah, I remember him being in the squad as well, and Marcos Senna, for some reason, stood out, because prior to the tournament, I didn't know he existed, you know, and then this guy turns up playing for Spain, and he was just phenomenal in that tournament. And like you say, I think it was very much a case of, at the start of, you could argue, the last great international side today. I don't really think since there has been a team that has had, you know, the same continued legacy over several years since this Spanish team kind of appeared at Euro 2008.
I mean, for you, Stephen, you know, a lover of the beautiful game, and you know, James Rightway mentions that, you know, the nucleus of this Spain side go on, you know, to win three major tournaments in a row, which is, you know, is phenomenal in itself. But I guess this is, you know, we're sort of lucky enough to sort of see the birth of a great international side at this tournament.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think we were all used to Spain, you know, predominantly going out the quarterfinals of major tournaments, you know, having so much promise. I mean, I can remember, you know, hosting the World Cup in 82 and being so abject, and the redemption in 84 when they got to the final of the European Championships. But then after that, every time that they tipped up a tournament, they were, you know, the notorious dark horse. You know, people would wearily tip them. You know, if they didn't fancy tipping Germany, there would be a weary kind of like, oh, maybe it's Spain's turn. You know, we all expect it to be Spain's turn at some point. You know, the 86 World Cup, you know, 1990. You know, all of these tournaments kept on passing with them kind of like, you know, dropping the ball, basically. And then here they were, finally. And they were the most deserved European Championship winners, I don't know, certainly since... Well, maybe the certainly since France, probably 84. You know, they were a wonderful, wonderful football on the side, and the talent that they had on the sidelines as well. You know, Xavi Alonso, you know, could only get games from the bench, basically. You know, it was cameo roles for Alonso. That midfield just, you know, trips off the tongue. And yes, there's Xavi, Fabregas, you know, Silva, with Senna as the protector. And Senna, as James said, you know, he's the great unknown quantity for so many people. And you know, he was a wonderful protector. And Villarreal, you know, who he played for, they also supply Cap de Vier to that side, and you know, an emerging Santi Cazorla as well. And they were such a talented side. And it goes forgotten that they were without David Villa for the final, having been so potent and powerful for them to be, you know, shown of him for the final against Germany, of all teams. And then, nope, still not a problem. You know, Torres, who'd kind of struggled throughout the tournament, rises to the occasion and wins it for Spain. And I think it was just one of the great, great stories of international football, and one of the European Championship's finest moments.
I mean, I know you've not been in Spain for very long, Gary, but in terms of you know, while you've been there, how... You know, like we said, there's this three tournament domination by Spain, you know, of international tournaments. But in terms of this 2008 side, where it all starts, how are they, you know, are they regarded more favourably, if you like, because, you know, they were the sort of the foundations, or is it the world, you know, the World Cup side 2 years later because of the nature of the competition that is more revered?
I guess, obviously there wasn't a fantastic difference between the two teams. I mean, there was real development, but not a great deal of difference. And yeah, I think they are, you know, Steve hit the nail on the head really well when he said, you know, they had this quarterfinal, semi-final, you know, England-itis, you know, qualifying well and then sort of falling at the, you know, the knockout stages, and it was a big hurdle to cross when this team got the first major title, and they went on the World Cup, as you said, and retained the title. And you know, certainly in Spain, this is looked upon as the greatest Spanish team. Bear in mind Spain have had some decent players over the years, but it was the collection of players. And you know, there again, you know, we were talking earlier about Lampard and Gerrard and Scholes, and in that final, they played, Spain played, Aragonés played Iniesta, Xavi, Fabregas and Silva in midfield. He made it work.
Yeah, it's a great comment to make, Gary. You're right. He did make it work. He absolutely did. Guys, we've been chatting for nearly an hour and a half. I feel like we've got lost in these tournaments. When you actually get started, and you get to talk about these things, and memories come up, and stories come up, and there's background moments to talk about, and it's been brilliant. It's been an absolute joy to listen to all three of you, and when Stephen had this idea, and you're going through the tournaments, and we're sort of portioning them up, and 2004 and 2008 for me, it was like, oh yeah, contrasting champions. It's all about Greece, then it's all about Spain, and that's going to be relatively straightforward. But it's been incredible, absolutely incredible to listen to. I suppose just to finish, your final thoughts, for you, James, it's your two, obviously you have a World Cup that sits in between, but with regards to your first sort of major international footballing experience, with regards to age, do you feel lucky? I sound like Clint Eastwood. Do you feel lucky with, where you sit with your introduction to international tournaments, and certainly with the 2004 championships?
I think that, being a Wrexham fan, I don't have much joy in life. So it's always nice to watch these underdogs and teams that you don't expect to do anything go on and succeed. And, Euro 2008, you look at, obviously, Russia and Turkey, they're two teams that you wouldn't have put in the semi-finals when the tournament kicked off. But it's often a case that these teams, they only go so far. So, yeah, I think absolutely. To see Greece go on and to actually win the tournament was something that it was extremely special. And I think it's going to be a long time, potentially an eternity, before we see that repeated to that degree.
Stephen, for you, finally, I'm not saying, do you have a favourite out of these two, but... You mentioned earlier that, and certainly with World Cups, it needs time before you can truly appreciate the tournament. But, we're only 12 years ago from 2008, 16 years ago from 2004, but already, as we've just said, an hour and a half later, these were good tournaments, good tournaments.
They were, and I think for me, at least personally, is that I continue to look forward to the European Championships off the back of each one. The fact that there were still only 16 teams, and that the quality of games and clashes was guaranteed from the start. There were no weak links, and that sounds awful to a World Cup and the inclusion of teams from other parts of the world. But yes, the World Cup brings some weaker nations to it. Getting better all the time. And I think that with the European Championships extending to a 2014 tournament, I certainly think for the next World Cup might be better than the European Championships. I think Russia 2018, the 32-team tournament, was better than Euro 2016. And I think that was the first time I'd had that experience. A film that a World Cup had felt better than a European Championship ever. It was the first time I'd ever really felt that, from certainly after those initial, responsive and kind of like early World Cups of 82 and 86. By the time you get to 1990, for me, you start to see the flaws in it and feel the pangs of disappointment that it's not lived up to expectations. But a European Championship didn't do that for me. European Championships moving into a 16-team tournament, I felt uneasy about it because I'd grown up on the 8-team tournaments, but the 16-team tournaments still continued to deliver exactly what I wanted from a major international tournament. And 2004 and 2008 did it again, and it made me look forward again to 2012. And yeah, those two tournaments, 2004 and 2008, they just, kind of provoked that kind of like in a child almost, you know, to really enjoy a major tournament. And for me, it was probably quite pronounced with both of them in a way, because I'm not anti-England, but I'm not, you know, they're not my team. They don't feel like my team. And I've said that before. And I'll say it a million times again, I'm sure. But I enjoyed the England team of 2004 because they were one of the best that I'd seen in a major tournament. And they should have gone further than the quarterfinals. So in 2004, I had that enjoyment of, you know, a very good England side and, you know, some decent sides, you know, scattered around the tournament. Then 2008, with no England side being there, made no dent in the tournament for me. But what 2008 gave me was that there were just so many teams that were playing so well. You know, Spain to rise the way they did, Germany to come back in the form that they did. You know, a really good Russian side. You know, as mentioned, though, Arshavin was fantastic for Russia in that tournament. He brushed off that early big defeat against Spain, got to the semi-finals, and that was as far as they should go. You know, the Netherlands were fantastic at this tournament in the group stages. They were outstanding. They looked like the team that Spain went on to be. You know, that could have been the Netherlands doing what Spain did in 2008. It was quite a shock in the manner that they did in the quarterfinals. But again, you know, another fantastic team that put in a fantastic performance, and, you know, this wild ride of luck that Turkey had, and then only to go out playing so well in the semi-finals. It was an outstanding tournament, Euro 2008, and, you know, it really was. And 2004, 2008 were great, you know, successes to what had come prior to that, as far as the European Championships go.
Brilliant. Final word with you, Gary. I suppose, you know, Stephen's put this together, and, you know, and sort of paired up the tournaments as, you know, as he has. And I think, you know, 2004, 2008 is a great contrasting tournaments to look at. And you only need to look at the winners of 2004 and 2008, you know, and straight away you have two really good talking points for two tournaments, and then once you go deeper, there's just more and more and more to look at in these two editions of it.
We've got to get it too long, Mikey, because you want me to stop what I was going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. These two tournaments, it's really good to look at them together because they are so contrasting in so many different ways. So we had, you know, it shows, firstly, there's more than one way to win a championship, because you couldn't almost get two more contrasting styles between the Greeks of 2004 and the Spanish of 2008. And it also had showed that sometimes a team can flare very brightly and then fairly quickly disappear, as the Greeks did, and other teams can almost launch a semi-dynasty, as the Spanish did, and they went on to win a World Cup and then the European trophy, defended the European Championship afterwards. So there's really some really good contrasts in between these two tournaments, I say. So it is really good that we sort of looked at these two together. But I just want to sort of say, we always have one sort of enduring moment memory from 2008. It was actually when we were in the bar when Torres scored. You know, I was sort of swept up in the emotion, but also jealous. You know, I want England to be able to do that and win a tournament and have that joy. But, you know, it was fantastic. The atmosphere was brilliant and everybody was happy. And it was a really fantastic moment. Football does that.
Brilliant. It does. Like I say, guys, I think this has actually probably been the longest one that we've done so far, which is quite surprising when we got the list out and looked at the competitions. James, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
No, it's a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. I mean, you talk about how, you know, going through these tournaments makes you feel young again. I mean, I feel like I'm 8 years old again. So it's been very nice to think about that for an hour and a half before, as I say, going back to the realities of having to finish a 9,000-word dissertation.
There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with going back to your childhood through football. Don't you worry about that. Stephen, obviously, like we say every time, you know, this is your brainchild, and it just seems to get better and better as we go along.
It's a joy to do. I mean, yeah, such brilliant tournaments, and you know, the great memories, because as Gary come third and then James will come up with something thinking, yeah, I remember that now. And things that, you know, no matter what you remember, there's always something that slipped the mind. And it's great just for it to all come flooding back.
It is. And obviously, Gary, you know, it's 2012, 2016 next. I can't wait to see what bars you were in for that one. And whether or not you'd managed to pick another host nation country to have a holiday in, or a winning nation, sorry. But yeah, thanks, Gary, as always.
You can't spend much better time than talking to your mates about football.
Absolutely. All that's left for me to say is, again, thanks, guys, and to thank everybody for listening, and to please join us again for what will be our final part, although there will be another a prelim one for the tournament when it actually takes place. But next time it's 2012-2016. So please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.